Our agenda for today is to talk about some issues of tzedakah and the obligation of the tzedakah as it applies to the individual, as it applies to the rabbi, and some of the decisions that have to be made as you evaluate limited resources. And we don't have infinite money, we don't have infinite ability to be helpful. So how do we decide various priorities in the midst of tzedakah? And we'll try to talk about that a little bit as a context for the whole question of what tzedakah is. And maybe say a few words also about the practice of Maaser Ksavim. So essentially, the mitzvah of tzedakah as one of our fundamental values and obligations really contains two components with it. And the components are relevant to trying to understand how exactly the mitzvah is fulfilled, because we have two different sets of priorities. And this is an idea that we find more explicitly when we talk about chesed. And tzedakah and chesed are two parallel concepts. The Gemara says in the end of Masechet Sukkah that chesed is actually greater than tzedakah, because tzedakah is something that you only do for the needy, and chesed is something you do for both the poor and the rich together. Chesed is something that you can do even for people who are no longer alive. Tzedakah you only do for people who are alive. And tzedakah you only do with your money, while chesed you do both with your money and yourself, with your time. So the Gemara says that chesed is greater than tzedakah, but it's clear that there's a parallel here, that tzedakah and chesed are two halves of the same coin, and that tzedakah is what we call chesed shebamamono. It's the acts of kindness that we do with our resources, as opposed to chesed in the more general sense, which is what we do with ourselves, what we do with our bodies. And when it comes to chesed, and presumably it's true about tzedakah as well, that chesed has two elements to it. And there's two separate commandments in the Torah. That on the one hand, there is the commandment of v'ahavta l'reicha kamocha, that one should love his fellow like he does himself, which is understood, at least by the Rambam, as an imperative to be helpful to people, to be there for their needs. And we also have a parallel track. We have a mitzvah which appears at least 8 times in the Torah in Sefer Dvarim of the halachta bedrachav, that we should walk in God's path. So what does it mean to walk in God's path? That means that we should be kind and compassionate people. Just like God is kind and compassionate, so too, that's who we should be. So two different tracks telling us to engage in chesed. The Rambam quotes both in his Sefer HaMitzvos, that we have to be like God, that means to be kind people, and we have to love our fellow, that means to be kind people. So why do we need two separate mitzvos that say the same thing? So many understand that we have two different goals, that on the one hand we want to be helpful to people, that's what V'ahavta l'reicha kamocha is telling us, do that which is helpful, and at the same time, we want to be godlike. So that means engage in acts of kindness, just like God is kind and is compassionate and is merciful, so too that's how we should be. So when you get involved in giving tzedakah, you get involved in helping people, you're doing that as well. So it seems like we have two different goals, which usually are parallel. They usually take us to the same place, they usually tell us to do the same kinds of things, but sometimes they diverge a little bit. Sometimes they'll take us in different directions, and you find that specifically in some examples in Hilchos Tzedakah that we'll talk about. And therefore, all of this is relevant to trying to figure out what exactly we're going to do when we try to figure out the best way to perform the mitzvah of tzedakah and the best way to make decisions. And what's particularly relevant also if you're going to be in a rabbinic role is that there is tzedakah that refers to the one who is giving tzedakah. There's the obligation of the donor to be charitable. And there also is the obligation that applies to somebody who manages the communal fund. So rabbis, for example, often have a rabbinic discretionary fund. There are other people who are involved in managing tzedakah funds in the times of the Gemara. There's discussion of gabbai tzedakah, the various people who are charged with that responsibility. Today we have professionals who work in fields, who work in organizations where they're distributing money. And that's actually an interesting combination, that is both chesed and tzedaka, that that is involvement in charitable giving, but it's done through your time. It's done through your involvement of yourself. You're donating your time rather than your money, so it's a combination of chesed and tzedaka, and the decisions that a person who's giving out public money has to make are similar but are sometimes very different, and are sometimes guided by different considerations. So that's particularly important if you're going to be involved in a communal fund, an rabbinic discretionary fund, and things like that. So there are some ways in which it overlaps, and there are some ways in which it diverges, and that's important to keep in mind. So to talk a little bit about how we look at all of these tracks together, and the assumption is that when you're talking about tzedakah, so tzedakah really has these two components as well. Tzedakah is something that we do to help people, it's something that we do to make sure people have what they need, and it's also something that we do in order to cultivate this divine personality, in order to make ourselves more godlike. And this was the major accomplishment, the major discovery of Avraham Avinu. Avraham Avinu discovered that there's a God in the world, and that his essence is kindness, his essence is chesed, and that he is going to follow in that path and teach all of his descendants. And God says, that's why I love him, that's why I have selected him, that he'll instruct all of his household and all of his descendants that they should follow in the path of chesed. So we try to accomplish both, and we try to figure out what considerations come from each. So one example is, what would you say about the following? So let's say you have a certain amount of tzedakah to give, and it's limited, you don't have infinite wealth. So how exactly are you going to disperse it? So should you look to see if there's maybe one recipient who you can give a lot of tzedakah to, and that'll make a big impact? Or should you say, no, I'll divide it up a little bit more, and I'll give smaller gifts to more people, so it's not going to have as big a splash in any one place, but I will give a little bit of tzedakah to more people. So what's the best approach? So there were those who felt that it's good to concentrate it and to give it into one place. That was the view of the Maharal and the Rabbi Yaakov Emden and a few others. But more well-known is the position of the Rambam, which in a sense was also the position of the Bach, that it makes sense to diversify. It makes sense to give many smaller gifts rather than one large gift. Hi.
The Rambam says, isn't the Rambam referring to giving, let's say, $10 bill?
Let's explain that. So I'm about to show you the difference between the Rambam and the Bach, but just first, the general thing is that they have in common is that they both talk about smaller gifts, and now to explain why, you'll see the difference between them. Have a question about that?
No, it's just a question. I think you probably get to the difference between, I was once told about the difference between tzedakah and chesed, where someone was arguing in the context of, let's say, not just Jewish people, if you want to deal with non-Jews or the larger world, where it's like, tzedakah would be more obligatory only in regards to a Jew and a Jew, where...
I don't know if that's necessarily true. Okay. We'll see if we get to that, let's see what time permits. But
try to leave the question to the end.
In general, see, we'll evaluate how much time we have to see if we can get to that. But essentially, so as Itzi's pointing out, that there is a difference in terms of how the Rambam formulates it and how the Bach formulates it, and that difference is significant. That the reason the Rambam says that it's kedai to give smaller gifts is the Rambam says that every time you reach into your pocket and you give somebody something, every time you write out a check, so that is an expression of generosity, and that's going to develop your spiritual personality. That's going to develop your godlike personality, and that's worthwhile, and that's going to have an impact. So even if it adds up to the same amount of money, but you're doing it through several acts of giving, each act of giving is something that's going to impact on who you are, and that's worthwhile. While the Bach says it differently. The Bach, actually, it's a little bit in Yonah D'Yom, almost. The Bach says this in Hilchos Purim. He's talking about Matanos Levyonim. So the Bach says it seems to him quite obvious that if you could give one big gift to one person, or you could give many smaller gifts to many people, that it's worthwhile to give many smaller gifts, because through that you will have sustained many more people, writes the Bach. So even though there's a similarity between the two, they're coming from two different places. Right, the Rambam seems to be coming from a v'halachta b'drachah consideration, that we want to be people who are involved in giving, involved in acts of generosity, because that will make us more godlike. So therefore, to do many more acts, presumably, even if it's all to the same person, would still be worthwhile, because each act of giving is going to have an impact on your soul. while the bath is really coming at it from a v'yahavta l'recha kamocha angle, that the more people who will be helped, that's his economic theory, that the world is better off if tzedakah is given out a little bit more evenly, so that's valuable. So that's the way to look at it, that look how we'll have an impact on the world, and assess it that way. So there are differences between the two, practically also, not just reflecting different halves of the equation, but also practically, the Rambam would say the same thing even if you're talking to one person, presumably assuming you're not torturing the guy and making him come back and get many gifts. That's also a part of the consideration. But if somehow it's consistent with helping him in a dignified fashion to give him many smaller gifts, so then the Rambam might say the same thing. While, according to the Bach, the whole point is that you're diversifying with different people. Also, a major difference for what we mentioned a few minutes ago is, what if it's not your money? Right? If it's not your money, if you are managing a public fund, so then you don't really have the right to make decisions based on what's going to give you more of a spiritual boost. When it's your own money, then you can make decisions like that. But if you're trying to decide how the communal money should be spent, so then that's going to be a little bit closer to objective. It's still going to involve discretion, but it's something that's a little bit more objective in its nature. And therefore, you could use the factor the world will be better off by dividing it up, but you probably couldn't use as a factor that I'll get more of a spiritual boost by giving it out this way. Discretion is going to be there anyway, and that's a major point which is worth mentioning at the beginning, that we'll talk about this a little bit more, but in Parshas Re'eh, so the Torah gives the mitzvah of tzedakah, so the Torah says that you have to open up your hand and give tzedakah, and lo sikpo tzedakah, you shouldn't clench your fist. You shouldn't close your fist and refuse tzedakah. So the Vilna Gaon interpreted al pi derech hadrush that when you have a closed fist, so it looks like all the fingers are the same size. It looks like everything's equal. But when you open your hand, you see that it's not true. You see that all your fingers are different sizes. So too, whenever you deal with hilchos tzedakah, so it's a unique area of halacha because you have rules. We have certainly halachos. There's a whole section in Yeridaya hilchos tzedakah. But at the same time, it's all going to be, at the end of the day, your discretion. It's going to be how you decide to integrate these rules into your discretionary decisions, because there's so many variables, we can't really know how to just plug everything into a computer and get the conclusion. So the Vilna Gaon suggested, al pi derech hadrush, that's what the pasuk is telling you. Don't look at it like a closed fist where everything looks like it's the same thing. But open up your hands and realize that everything's different. So a part of that has to do with the fact that there's so many variables, we can't really make everything fit into one neat computer program. And there's always going to be a space for discretion, but there's different kinds of discretion. So there's the individual's discretion, where he has the right to do things more based on his personal considerations. And there is the more objective, communal kind of discretion, where you're also allowed to make decisions, but the decisions have to follow something along a more objective standard. So we talk about a rabbinic discretionary fund, so we're essentially saying that there is rabbinic discretion, that there is a discretion which is about him making decisions, about the rabbi making decisions, but the rabbinic discretion is an educated discretion. It's a discretion that comes from being exposed to what these makoros say, and then the decisions are going to flow from that. So one question will be, then are you going to give to one person or are you going to give to many people? And that might be influenced differently, whether it's your money or whether it's public money. Hi.
The Bach and the Rambam come from the perspective that even if you spread it up, it will still make some sort of an impact.
The assumption is, you have to assume, practically speaking, that if we're talking about diluting things so much that you're not helping anybody at all, that it's going to be a negligible amount, then nobody would say that that's worthwhile. And that even if, maybe on the Rambam's consideration, it's worth something, and that everything, every act of generosity is something, but if it's going to result in a completely ineffectual act of tzedakah, the Rambam's going to acknowledge that that's going to be outweighed. So when we talk about having two different considerations here, they can take you to different places, but we try not to totally negate one or the other. So sometimes we'll emphasize one factor of the Havalachta Bedracha more than the V'Havta Reicha Kamocha, and sometimes they'll supplement each other, but presumably we don't want one to be negated. You know the famous story about the Chassid who wanted to visit the Rebbe, and the Rebbe was sick, and the Chassid wanted to come visit him, and the Rebbe said, it's not a good time, I don't want you to visit now. And the Chassid said, no, I really want to come and visit. And the Rebbe said, no, it's not a good time, don't come now. And the Chassid said, no, I really, really want to come. I want to be Mekayim the mitzvah of Bikur Cholim. And the Rebbe said, I'm not a lulav. You know, it's not that kind of a mitzvah. It's not that mitzvah where you have a chefza and you just do it and it's not, it doesn't have any feelings. That the whole mitzvah of chesed is going to require that you do it in a way that helps the person. And that also addresses these two components, that the v'ahavta re'echa kamocha certainly requires that you help the person, and the v'ahavta b'drachav may connect more to your experience through doing it, but even the v'ahavta b'drachav only makes sense if it's something that's actually going to be the mitzvah, which presumably has to help somewhat. So that's one consideration, and it says in the Shulchan Aruch that one should not give all of his tzedakah to one recipient. That's based on the Gemara in Maseches Erevin, where the Gemara says that someone who gives all of his matnas kahuna to one person, to one kohen, ends up bringing famine to the world. Mariyat es ha'olam, the world essentially doesn't work that way. That's going to be so lopsided. One person is getting everything, so that's not wise. That's what the Shulchan Aruch says. You shouldn't give all your tzedakah to one person. The Maharsham writes that he assumes that that's true on a lifetime level, that if you have projects, sometimes you have a class will collect tzedakah every month for one goal, and they'll say, okay, this month we're doing for one thing, next month we'll do for something else. So, okay, that's different. That's not giving all your tzedakah in one place. It means over the course of a lifetime, if you're only going to give tzedakah to one recipient, that's not necessarily going to be so effective in terms of helping the world. Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky pointed out another consideration that's relevant specifically to the one who is in charge of communal funds. So a part of his responsibility is not just to be objective, but also is to appear objective, is also to be transparently objective, because he's also responsible not just for honestly distributing the money, but also that he has to encourage people to give more. So people might think that, oh, if I give to the fund, then the guy who's in charge, he just gives it to his favorite causes and nobody else gets anything, so then they're not going to give anymore. So you're also charged with the responsibility of making sure that the fund grows. So therefore, it's also another element that requires a certain level of objectivity. So Rabbi Yaakov writes in his comments to the Shulchan Aruch, and obviously Yaakov to the Shulchan Aruch, that that's also a part of the responsibility as far as giving out tzedakah and how we do that. So moving beyond that point, so we can address one of the major questions in tzedakah. So the major theme that we find in Parshas Re'eh, when the Torah tells us about this obligation to give tzedakah, so there are a couple of important phrases that the Torah has. So one thing that the Torah tells us is that we should open up our hands, that we should provide for the Evyon who is in need of tzedakah, and we shouldn't clench our fists, we shouldn't clench our fists, we shouldn't harden our hearts, and we should provide day machsoro. So what exactly does day machsoro mean? So literally it means whatever is lacking, that's what we should provide. We should provide tzedakah for whatever is missing. So the Gemara tells us in Maseches Ksubis, on the Samach Zayin, Shiva's Maseches, yeah, and it's also a Daf Yomi, a few months, we'll get there. So the Gemara tells us a couple of principles that all really derive from this idea of day machsoro, that whatever is objectively lacking, that's something that we try to provide. So there are certain basic needs. So the Mishnah and the Gemara talk about somebody doesn't have what to eat, if somebody doesn't have where to live, if somebody's not able to get married. So there are certain basic expenses that are included within day machsoro, and that's considered to be mechusar, that's considered to be something that's missing, and therefore you have to fill that in. And then there is a more emotionally based day machsoro, that if somebody is accustomed to a certain lifestyle and he's lacking it now because he had a financial downfall, so he doesn't have the ability to provide for himself what he used to be able to. So then it sounds like from the Gemara, and this is a very complicated point, but it sounds like from the Gemara that we're obligated to provide that which he's used to. So what exactly does that mean practically speaking? Gemara gives some very extreme examples. The Gemara says that even if somebody had a practice that he used to have servants running in front of him, that he should provide that. They should provide him with servants who would run in front of him. And the Gemara says that Hillel used to hire servants to run in front of somebody who was in such a position. And then when he couldn't find them one day, he did it himself. And this is apparently a part of the obligation. So the Gemara seems to suggest that there is potentially this very high standard of what de machsoro could require. And what emerges then is also a third factor, that on the one hand, there are things that are objectively necessary for people, then there is a higher level of standard of living for people who were used to that, people who had a history with a certain level of luxury. It's hard for them to be without that. And then there's also a standard that may not be something somebody's used to, but that everyone else around them has. That if that's the standard of living around them, so then in terms of defining the first set, let's say what they get to eat and where they get to live, and things like that, and the things that come along with marriage, so whatever the communal standard is, that also could be considered lacking for a person if they don't have it. So essentially all of those could fulfill a definition of that which is lacking. That's what the Torah identifies as the recipient of Staka, De Machsaro Asher Yechsarlo. This is Perek Tezvav, Pasuk Ches, and Sefer Dvarim. So all of these things could be identified as something is missing, and that's something that you have to fulfill. But the Gemara also says there's certain limitations, that you're not obligated to enrich someone, that if somebody wants to be wealthy and they weren't wealthy to begin with, so then you're not obligated to make them rich, and that these more extreme obligations of De Machsaro, that's for somebody who specifically was used to that. But if somebody just decides that's what he wants, so then that's not considered to be in the heading of De Machzoro, and that's not an obligation. So that provokes a lot of questions, because theoretically that could be very extreme. Theoretically that could require you to do a lot. So how is anyone supposed to handle this? How is anyone supposed to be able to provide De Machzoro? This is especially a question in light of the fact that the Gemara has in Daf Nun in Ksuvos, we'll get up to that in Daf Yomi a little bit sooner, that there is a limitation on staka. So maybe we'll talk, I know the earlier wants to address a little bit the idea of Maisa Ksofen, that the notion that one is recommended, encouraged to give a minimum of 10% of his money to staka, but the Gemara has what seems to be a Dinder Abanan, that one should give a maximum of a fifth. One should give a maximum of 20%. Hamavazves, al yavazves, yosem echomish. That you shouldn't give too much of your money away for tzedakah, because we're afraid that if you do that, you're going to impoverish yourself. So it's interesting, because that also reflects the tension sometimes between v'halachta b'drachav and v'ahavta re'echa kamocha. But if somebody wants to be very godlike, if somebody wants to be very much holech b'darchei Hashem, so you might think, okay, I'll give away everything. If I don't have any material possessions, then I'm incredibly godlike. I'll just give away everything. This is something that Rishon Mishkapin, the Rabbi Nisishiva Rishon Mishkapin, in the Hakdama to the Shari Yosher, so he talks about this as Amida specifically, the Kadosh Baruch Hu, the human beings can't attain, that they can just, God can not care about himself. He doesn't have human needs, so he takes care of everybody else. So somebody wants to be very godlike and think, okay, I'll give away everything, and that'll be fantastic. That's the most v'alachta v'drachav I could possibly do. So that might be true, but as far as v'ahavta re'echa kamocha, it's not necessarily such a good thing, because you won't be able to be involved in staka anymore, and you're going to have to take from staka now. So that's not so productive. So if we're worried about helping people, so helping people is going to mean that we have to be a little bit more planned out about it, then you can't give away more than a fifth of your money. So the Svarim asks, so how exactly do we balance these two things? So if you're not supposed to give away more than a fifth of your money to tzedakah, and you have an obligation to provide all the luxuries for somebody who used to have luxuries, so how exactly do you do both? You can't do both. Even if you didn't have a limitation of a fifth, then you probably couldn't pull it off. But if you have a one-fifth limitation, then certainly it's not going to be practically possible. So this was a whole debate on the side of the page of the Shulchan Aruch, that the Ramah and many others assume that the obligation of De Machzoro is not an obligation that applies to any one individual, but it applies to the community as a whole. It applies to the tzibur. That together, everyone has to worry about the people around them, and they have to make sure to provide as much as we can for their needs. But any one individual doesn't have a chiyuv De Machzoro to fulfill the needs up to the nth degree of somebody who may have very extreme needs. So that's a machlokus. Not everyone assumed like that. There were those who felt it was an obligation on the individual. But Rav Vosner has a tshuva about this, where he writes that the reality paskins like the Ramah. Even if you don't think the Ramah is right independently, but the reality is like that. It's simply impossible for any one individual to provide de machzoro for even one other individual, probably let alone for everybody in the community. So. So in terms of Hillel or in terms of... Right, so the case of the Gemara has various cases where some people give large amounts, some give smaller amounts. It seems like they're able to do it. If you're able to do it, so then that's a part of joining in. They probably couldn't do it for everybody, so they did their part. And the point is, together, they're all going to manage the Day Machzor for everybody, hopefully. It's interesting, one could be medayik, without getting into all the lumdus now, that one could say that some of the Rishonim seem to point in the opposite direction, because the Gemara has a little bit of a tension. On the one hand, the Gemara says you have to provide even luxuries. On the other hand, the Gemara also says that if somebody is taking from tzedakah, and they have luxurious items in their house, they have golden candlesticks or whatever, they have fancy things, that they have to sell them. So how do you reconcile the two? That here, if somebody needs luxuries, we have to provide them, and if somebody has luxuries, they have to sell them in order to get stuck. It seems to be a contradiction to the idea of Dei Machzoro. So there's a number of different ways to address that, probably five different shittos in Rishonim. But what emerges from at least one view is that somebody who's taking stucker from individuals, okay, so then we don't make him sell his luxuries. But if somebody's coming from the public fund, so then before he's going to take money from the public fund, then he has to sell his luxurious items before taking money. So if that's the reconciliation, it comes out that de machzoro is really for the individual, as opposed to for the community. The community, they have to just go on basic necessities. They can't necessarily go to take care of luxuries. But an individual, he can take care of the greater needs. That's de machzoro. So that's the opposite of what we just heard from the Rama, right? That the Rama said that it's only on the community de machzoro. And here what we're saying is that the community doesn't do de machzoro, the community just does the basic needs. So I think there's really three levels. That the communal fund has to address the basic needs and has to be somewhat more, so to speak, responsible about worrying about whether all the other anim are going to be taken care of also. And they can't go too much on any one ani who maybe has other options because they have to worry about the community as a whole. But an individual has a mitzvah of de machzoro, which is really about the valachta bedrachov kind of idea. It's really about the kiyum mitzvah of the individual. He fulfills tzedakah most perfectly when he is going to take care of everything that this individual needs. That's really a mitzvah that's more to the individual than it is to the community. So what's the Rama talking about? The Rama is talking about the chiyuv of de machzoro, the obligation, not just the mitzvah, but the obligation to make sure you get it all, so that, practically speaking, no one individual could do. So between the community, but among everybody, you try to make sure that this is addressed. And that could then involve situations which are a little more extreme, and then you have to figure out when it's appropriate and when it's not. Some point out that the idea of Hillel running in front of this person who needs avadim running in front of him is really to show that that's a little bit of a crazy thing. Who's going to need this? That's kind of a mishagas, and that maybe that's the point, that some things are just emotional needs that aren't really tying into anything practical. Or even more so, maybe that's about kavod, to show that it's not just about money, but sometimes you have people who aren't even poor, but they have requirements in the area of kavod. They need to be treated in a certain way. And that's also part of de machzoro, that we have an attentiveness to all of these emotional needs as well, and that's also a part of it. So there are a number of dinim which come out from this Gemara about this Gemara in Ksuba is talking about what does it mean to focus on de machzoro. So it means that we have to focus on that which is lacking, and that which is lacking could mean actual needs, could mean emotional needs, it could mean anything along that spectrum, and presumably that all connects to the individual's mitzvah and how he fulfills it. There are also limitations that come from de machzoro. So the Gemara says that if you have a person who's not asking for tzedakah, so then you have a mitzvah to help him out anyway, and to find a way to help him out that's going to work. So the Gemara says if he's not interested in taking tzedakah, so first you should try to tell him that it's a gift, it's not a charitable donation, it's a gift. If that's not going to work, so then you have to try to convince him it's a loan, and then you don't collect it later. And then if he's not willing to accept it as a loan, you take a mashkon from him, and you convince him that you are going to take it back, and then you still don't end up necessarily collecting it. In this week's parasha, we also find that lending people money is considered to be a huge chesed and one of the major obligations, the whole reason we have the concept of prosbul. And the Torah says this year is the Shemitah year, that we're worried that people aren't going to fulfill the mitzvah of lending money, which is one of the major chasadim that we do to help people out who are in a bad financial state. So that's when that's even a direct loan, where you know you plan on collecting it. But the Gemara in Ksubas is saying that there are circumstances where you don't really think you're going to ever collect it. It's not really a loan, but you may have to fake a loan in order to get the person to accept it. That's a part of the obligation of tzedakah. So there's an additional mitzvah, that the idea also that Chavetz Chaim points out in the Sefer Avos Chesed, that in addition to this pasuk of Adai Dei Machzoro, the Torah also says that if somebody is about to stumble, if somebody is about to have a financial downfall, right now it looks like they're able to live the way they always did, but there's something that could trip, they could lose their money, and you're in a position to loan them some money to bridge the gap so that you can keep them from ever needing staka. So that's a particular mitzvah of hachazakta, that you could support them from falling, and the Chafetz Chaim writes that's a very high staka priority, that even more maybe than helping an ani is helping somebody who would become an ani unless you help them. And that's a tremendous mitzvah of staka. So that could be in addition to the concept of de machzaro. So the Gemara essentially says, if you see there are people who are lacking something, even if they're not asking, so there's a mitzvah of staka. And then there's the question of the inverse. So what if somebody has money, but he's not willing to take care of himself? So then the Gemara has two opinions about that. One opinion is that you lend him money anyway, and this time you do collect it back, but then he's not going to go along with that, so you have to wait till after he dies and collect it from his yarshim, but you do a whole scheme to make sure that he does take care of himself. Or the other opinion of the Gemara is that you don't have to take care of him, that that's not your responsibility. So some of the Rishonim, the Ritva, and the Tosfos and Bava Metzia explain that that's also from De Mafsaro, that the person is not chaser, the person happens not to be taking care of himself, but he's not lacking, he has, but he's not doing it, that's not necessarily the common responsibility. It's a big machlokus whether or not that extends to somebody who doesn't have, but could be working. So if somebody could be sustaining themselves, so the Ma'ishtam has a tshuva where he says that's also not considered to be chaser. This person's not lacking because he has the ability to make the money. Others disagreed. Others assumed that maybe at least you have a minimal obligation to help somebody. It doesn't really matter why it is if they don't have. And it does seem from the Gemara in Ksubis that when you prioritize staka, so if one person has the ability to find other ways to make money and one person doesn't, so right now they're both poor, but one person has other avenues they can pursue and one person doesn't, then at least as far as a priority, you prioritize the person who has fewer alternative venues, so that would seem to be relevant to that discussion. But in any event, that's also something that emerges from this whole din of de machzoro, that whatever is lacking, de machzoro shayetzolo, whatever is lacking, that's what you have to provide, and what's not lacking, you don't have to provide. It's all two sides of the same coin. But what was very scary is the pasuk before this, and we mentioned this a few minutes ago, but the pasuk says that lo sa'ameis es levavcha v'lo sikpos es yadcha me'achicha ha'avyon, that you're not allowed to harden your heart and you're not allowed to clench your fist, which sounds like that there's a prohibition involved. There's actually two prohibitions involved in refusing tzedakah. That if somebody asks you for tzedakah and you say no, it sounds like you're in violation of two lavin. You might have thought this was one lavin, this was a poetic way of saying it, but there's a Tosfos again in Seches Ksuvis and Daf Mem Tes, which refers to two lavin coming from this pasuk. Maybe you would have thought this was no lavin, this was just a poetic way of saying give tzedakah, so Tosfos is helpful in emphasizing to us that this is actually a lavin, it's actually a two lavin, two Torah prohibitions. That's very scary. So you're saying that if somebody asks you for tzedakah, and that happens to us all the time, and you say no, so it's like wearing shatnez and eating treif at the same time. It's like you're violating two lavin at the same time. So that's very scary. So what exactly is the nature of this prohibition? How exactly do you deal with this? So there is a machlokas. It's not going to help you that much, but there is a machlokas whether these yisurim apply only if somebody actually asks you, or even if they don't ask you, but you know that they need. So it sounds like the Rashba in the Sefer Shavuos and Daf Kafei, the Rashba quotes an opinion that the yisurim only apply if somebody actually asks you. While the Rambam in Sefer HaMitzvahs, the Rambam sounds that as long as you know they're aniyim, even if they haven't asked you, you don't give them, you're in violation of these lavim. So even if you want to be makel like the Rashba, it's still not so easy, because the opinion of the Rashba quotes, because there are enough people who actually do ask, and we're not able to fulfill all those needs. So even if we take that more makel view, it's still a little complicated. It sounds like from the Gemara that we mentioned in Ksubas, that you have to take care of people even if they're not looking for tzedakah, so it sounds like there's at least a mitzvah of tzedakah even if they're not asking. It doesn't necessarily mean the losaseh is applied, but at least there's a mitzvah. So to focus on the losa says, so how do you deal with this? How do we avoid being in violation of these yisurim all the time? So that's a tricky thing. So that's a whole discussion. First of all, some assume that this is only together with de machzoro. So you have to have an obligation first of de machzoro to have the prohibitions. And de machzoro, it's paskin and shulchan aruch, that only applies to people in your community. That if you have somebody who's roving around, who's going from place to place, so you have to help them out a little bit, you have to give them a ton of muetes, but you don't have to worry about de machzoro. So to get these low sick boats, that comes together with de machzoro. But again, that's still a lot. So we don't necessarily have the ability to help everybody who comes to us from our community. So there is an approach that some Achronim have. It's based on the Rishonim or the Rambam. It sounds like this in Sefer HaMitzvos. Question about that? Oh, that's a great question, so we'll see if we can talk about that. But in terms of these prohibitions, so there is an approach, and it sounds like this very much from the Rambam and Sefer HaMitzvos, that there are all kinds of reasonable reasons why somebody might say no to give tzedakah. Right? So if somebody asks you for tzedakah, so you might say no because we have priorities and this person's not the highest priority. You might say no because you don't have any money. You might say no because you already gave more than a fifth, like we said, that you have a limitation of giving a fifth. You might say no because you don't trust the person. And the Gemara also there in Ksubas suggests that you have an obligation to be aware of whether the person is honest or not, or at least a defense. The Gemara has a statement over there in Samachesim at Aleph and Ksubas, which sounds a little bit cynical, that we should be grateful for the fact that there are liars in the world, that Bo, V'nach, Siktov, L'Ramoyim, we should give write a thank you letter to all the liars, because if it were not for them, we'd really be in trouble, because we'd be considered sinners that we say no to people who ask for tzedakah. But since some people are dishonest, so we're able to excuse ourselves by saying we're always afraid that the person asking is dishonest, and therefore we're lucky that that happened. They're lucky that that exists. So that's also a reasonable reason to say no. So there are reasons that are acceptable to not give tzedakah to a request. If you're not, you don't trust the person, you have other priorities, you don't have any money, you don't have any more available for tzedakah. So there are reasonable reasons. But that's not what the pasuk is talking about. If we assume the pasuk is literal and is not poetic, so it doesn't say don't say no. It says lo sa'ame says levavka, velo sikbo says yodcha. It says don't harden your heart and don't clench your fist. So essentially, what's it addressing? It's addressing that if somebody says that stuck is not my problem, I don't have to worry about anybody else. I have a clenched fist, I have a hard heart, it's not my job to care if anybody else is suffering, so then you're in trouble, then you're in violation of lavin. So if you say no because of that, so then that's what this pasuk is talking about. But if you say no because you'd love to help but you just can't, or you're just not sure if this is the best recipient, so then that's not a violation of these lavin, and that's how many assume. So that's an important idea, which again connects to the whole valachta bedrachav component as opposed to v'hatlarecha kamocha, that valachta bedrachav is about making sure that our midos are godlike. So that's maybe what the lavin are addressed, and the Rambam almost says it pretty much explicitly in Sefer HaMitzvos, that that pasuk is telling us that we should not become stingy, cruel people, and therefore we shouldn't do things that embolden that quality. So if you're going to say, I'm refusing tzedakah because I don't care about you, that's going to strengthen this midah of being cruel, of being stingy, and that's what the Torah is talking about. But if it's not coming from a place of cruelness, so then it's not coming from stinginess, so then that's not necessarily subject to that. And it could be also that the next pasuk is also focusing on the valachta bedracha of Sefer Dvarim themes that we said before, that maybe De Machzara was also more about how you fulfill the mitzvah of staka rather than necessarily from a v'ahavta l'recha kamocha component. So all of that's going to factor in into how you make decisions about which aniyim are going to help and to what degree you're going to help them and how exactly you're going to allocate the resources that you have. And then there is a lot to discuss. Okay, so now you decide what qualifies as an ani. So you still have a lot of aniyim who qualify. So how are you going to decide who's going to come first? How are you going to decide who you're going to pay attention to first? So first, you take care of your relatives. This is something which is not always a popular idea, that it seems to be a little bit more exciting to get involved with people very far away. But halacha tells us really the other way around, that we have a din of taking care of our relatives, that whoever is the closest relation, that should come first. And you'd think that it goes based on a Yerusha type of structure, that whoever inherits first would come first. That's almost true, but it's an exception that you go to the parents first. The parents don't inherit first. The parents do get tzedakah first. And it seems to be that that's because there is a mandate of Kibud Av V'Aim that is grafted onto this also. So that also shows us something, that when we talk about our tzedakah decisions, so sometimes we have internal tzedakah decisions, that the rules of tzedakah tell us to go in one direction, and sometimes it's because we have other factors, other mitzvos that are involved that also push us in that direction. So when it comes to parents, so you have a mitzvah of Kibud Av V'Aim, and that's the first priority, and that's some of the contemporary svarim they point out. This is something which most people don't really acknowledge, that they don't feel that their parents are people they should be giving tzedakah to. It's uncomfortable, and it's not something that really comes to mind. But the halacha really says the opposite. You have to find a way to do it in a dignified fashion. You shouldn't treat your parents like they're like you're doing them a favor, but they are the recipient. If you have needy parents, so then that's where the first tzedaka goes. And the Chasam Sofer has a tshuva where he says that's really the overwhelming priority in a different way than we normally talk about priorities. All the other priorities that we talk about, so we talk about kedimus and tzedaka, so what that means is that it doesn't mean the order in which you give out the checks. It means that you have a limited amount of money, so who's your first concern? So your first concern is whoever is highest on the list. And then most of the poskim assume that it doesn't mean that if you have a certain amount of tzedaka to give, so then you look to whoever's first on your list and you give them everything until they've totally taken care of that. And then if there's anything left over, then you go to number two. And then anything left over, you go to number three. So most of the poskim assume that's not what it means. It means that you give the majority, whether it's a half, two-thirds, the different ways of counting, but you give a big portion of your money to whatever is first on the list. And then you give a big portion of what's left to whoever's next. And then whatever big portion of what's left to whatever is next. And through that, it goes into proportional decreasing amounts, but you give a little bit to causes as far as you can extend yourself, as far as you can keep going. So then you continue covering as many causes as you can. But the Chasam Sofer says that if you have needy parents, so then that's the overwhelming priority. And even at the expense of other causes, that's where your tzedaka should go. But beyond that, so we have a general priority of relatives, and that's the point where, again, you find a big difference between somebody who's giving private money and somebody who's administering a public fund. And here, the halacha is mamish the opposite, punkt fakert, that somebody who is giving out their own money is obligated to prioritize their relatives, and somebody who's giving out public money is prohibited from prioritizing their relatives. Because that's not an objective standard. And the Gemara has criticism of people who were involved in giving out stock, and the Rishonim explained that what they did wrong is that they prioritized their relatives. If you have public money, so then you don't have the right to make decisions based on that, but private money you do. So that's an actual flip halacha, that it depends whether it's your money or somebody else's money. That could be a very relevant question, again, if you're involved in the rabbinic funds. So this difference is a very significant difference. And it seems like the idea of providing your relatives, that's A, coming from a v'halachta v'drachav component, because that's where your kiyum ha-mitzvah is greatest. We have a pasuk in Yeshayah tells us, mibsarcha al tisalem, you have an obligation to be there for those who are related to you. But it could also be true from a v'yahav t'arecha kamocha component, that it's also true as far as this deficiency of tzedaka, that part of the system is that we hope that all the aniyim will be taken care of, so hopefully aniyim have relatives, and if we tell every person that he's obligated to prioritize his relatives, so then we hope that that will also create a reality where more aniyim will be taken care of through distributing among various relatives. So that's one consideration. Then there's also the consideration that the Shulchan Aruch talks about people who are greater tzaddikim than others. It's a big question whether or not that applies nowadays. Rav Kook has a truth that many others assume, that nowadays we're not in a position to judge people's tzedakos, to judge their righteousness and their merit, and to decide how to give out based on that. But as Rav Moshe Feinstein points out, that here also it's flipped, that the idea of giving to people who are most worthy, that's only for the public fund. Because the private money, that's supposed to go to the relatives. So the private people should prefer relatives and not make any distinction based on righteousness and worthiness. And the public money, maybe they should make decisions based on worthiness, and they're not allowed to decide based on their relatives. But even they probably don't really have much room to examine how worthy people are, and it's not really such a relevant consideration nowadays. And even that consideration that we mentioned a few minutes ago about whether somebody is able to work or not and make money for their own self, so that's also a discussion, but practically speaking, it's very hard to know that very often somebody's not going to work because of whatever reason that we don't realize, that it's not possible for them to work, and it seems to us like it is possible, and very often it'll be the case that it's not possible. So usually the assumption is that there's more to the picture than we appreciate, and if somebody is needy, that's usually going to be enough, and we're not going to make any assessment that they could provide for themselves. Even if they seem to be rich, and we said before that if somebody is rich and is just simply not taking from their own funds in order to support themselves, so the Gemara concludes you're not obligated to worry about him. So the Sefer Rishon Letzion, all the later poskim quote, that's assuming you know that for a fact. That sometimes a person, you think he's rich, but he actually has much less than he has, and he doesn't want the whole world to know, so he's keeping up appearances, but he actually does need help. So if that's possibly the case, and if you don't know that's the case, then you should still give him tzedakah, that it's only a very narrow situation where you really know that somebody actually has the assets and he doesn't have any kind of hidden problems that may be there, and then he's not choosing to use it himself, okay, then there's something to talk about. But if there's at all a possibility that he's keeping up appearances, doesn't want people to know that he's had a financial downfall, so then you still have to take care of him with tzedakah. And many of the Rishonim understand that that's actually what Deh Machzoro is about. That Deh Machzoro is about, in its more luxurious forms, it's there to prevent somebody from being exposed as somebody who's lost his money, because that comes with a degree of embarrassment and loss of dignity. So a part of the Deh Machzoro is to save them from that. There was a view, in fact, in the Shita Mekubetzes, quotes the Gaonim, it says that the reason that the whole halacha of Deh Machzoro, in terms of the more luxurious manifestations, it's only for somebody who's an ani that is not revealed publicly as an ani, that somebody who the world thinks is still well off, and you know that he needs, so that's where the mitzvah of Deh Machzoro is, to keep him from having to be exposed as an ani. But if he's already been exposed as an ani, so then there's no mitzvah of Deh Machzoro. Reb Chaim Kanievsky, in his Sefer on the Rambam, in Derech Emunah, he writes that practically speaking, the poskim have not made such a distinction. We don't assume that there's such a limitation on Deh Machzoro. But the point is interesting anyway. The point is that we certainly try to help people not have to tell the world that they're needy. So that's understandable. So that could often be the case. So if it's not 100% clear that the person has assets to support themselves or has other options, then we have to assume that if they appear to be needy, that they are recipients of tzedakah. We're not going to really make distinctions based on other possible sources of money that they might have. Except in terms of priority, sometimes you have to choose between one or the other. So then the Gemara does say, if somebody has other options, so then they're going to be less of a priority. But in terms of receiving tzedakah, at least theoretically, so then that's not necessarily a distinction we can make. So we have to choose between people who are related to us, people who are worthy and the like. And then there is the famous consideration of Aniya Ircha Kogman, that we should give to the people who are from our ear. So that's a very important principle in tzedakah. And in the Piskei Tshuva, in the bottom of the Shulchan Aruch, the quotes from the Sefer Shemesh Tzedakah, who says that that's the most important principle in tzedakah, that everything else is assuming Aniya Ircha. That within Aniya Ircha, then we can start distinguishing. But the first consideration is that they should be Aniya Ircha. It turns out the Miri said this also. The Miri was hidden for a lot of centuries, but the Miri later on in the Sefer Tzedakah, in a different sugya, the Miri seems to imply that that's the first standard. Everything we first look to Aniya Ircha, and then we can talk about it. That's also perhaps assuming, though, it's a balance between Aniya Ircha and comparable needs. The Hafla, who wrote a Sefer on Ksubis, but he was the Rebbe of the Chassam Sofer, so he wrote also the Sefer Panim Yofos on Chumash. So the Chassam Sofer, his Tshuvas, quotes from the Panim Yofos, that he says in his Pasuk, Ki yeh v'cha evyon me'echad achacha, be'echad sharecha, be'artzacha. So Chazal darshan these words, that someone is related to you, me'echad achacha, be'echad sharecha, somebody from within your gates, that it gets to the whole idea of Aniya Ircha, that the Panim Yofos explains, the Pasuk is talking about people who are in proximity to you, but it's also balanced, kiya v'cha, that's your close relatives, that's your father, he comes first, like the Chassam Sofer writes, and then we start talking about evyon. So evyon means to be needy, and we have expression called toiv, toiv kodem, whoever is more needy comes first. So many of the posts can assume that all of these priorities are assuming that there's comparable needs, then we can start distinguishing between different people who have comparable needs. But if there's a very extreme disparity, some person is very needy and the other person has a living standard that slipped a little bit but is not as needy, so then that's also going to factor in. So practically speaking, it seems that we balance between the two, that we're considering a little bit degrees of neediness, and we're considering also the Aniya Ircha, and we're trying to find a balance between the two. Do you have a question?
Yeah, I just want to clarify. So these big Judah would say that Aniya Ircha Kodem, so if their relatives lived out of town, then they wouldn't have as much priority.
It would seem like it, yeah, that this is the biggest priority. They have a pasuk, Tov Shachin Karuv Me'ach Rochav, that a close neighbor is even better than a faraway brother, that it's possible that that's true. So this Aniya Ircha has a big role in terms of tzedakah priorities. So the question is, what does it mean, practically speaking? And also, why is it true? Why do we have such an idea that the Aniya Ircha should come first? So there are some who understood that it's a practicality issue, that we have a notion of of Eima Aviron al HaMitzvos, that we don't pass up mitzvah opportunities. So we try to take the mitzvahs that come to us first. You have an opportunity that's right in front of you, so you're not going to pass that up for a farther away opportunity. That could be also phrased more practically, not just Eima Aviron al HaMitzvos as a mitzvah principle, but that you want to accomplish more by dealing with that which is more immediately available to you. So the assumption is that the people who are nearby, the people you can take care of first, the people who are farther away, is going to delay and therefore make the impact of tzedakah less. However, if that was really the reason, so then that would have major implications. The Torah quotes from the Rebar Baruch. The Rebar Baruch says that if somebody comes from somewhere else, but right now they're in your neighborhood, so they have a din of aniyah yercha. But the Torah assumes not that way. The Torah assumes aniyah yercha, people who actually are a part of your community, not somebody who's just coming from somewhere else right now. So then it's not really about proximity, it's about them actually being a part of your community. So if that's the case, this also has other implications, because nowadays it was all about proximity, so you can make donations on the internet or over the phone, you can donate all around the world in a matter of seconds, so it's not really a factor so much. So presumably it's not about proximity and about speed, but it's about somebody who you have a shayichus to. And that's how many poskim assume, Rav Shechter always says like this, other poskim have made this point as well, that it's not really about geographic proximity, but it's about people who you have an involvement with, people who you know. It's like some of the poskim write, that if you have a chavrusa who's needy, he doesn't live in your neighborhood, but you deal with him every day, so you know that he's needy, so your chavrusa is probably going to take a higher priority than your neighbor, because this person you have more of a connection to, you have more of a shaykhis to. And so too, as Rav Shechter points out often, when you're dealing with supporting institutions, so maybe you'll support the institutions that your children went to, even if they're not necessarily the closest to you, but it's an institution that you have a connection to, you have a shaykhus to. But that's what we mean when we talk about aniyah yercha kodmim. So it seems that aniyah yercha kodmim is not really about proximity, it's about the whole notion of chesed, that the idea of chesed, this is something also that Rav Shimon talks about, Rav Shimon Shkab talks about in the introduction to Shari Yosher, that the whole idea of chesed is that you try to take care of yourself, that's your first responsibility, and then you try to include as many other people as you can. So you go in a straight line, and you try to make yourself expansive. He says, that's Pshat in the Mishnah. The Mishnah says, Emeina nili mili, chshanila atzmi imani, which sounds like it's two opposing points. Emeina nili mili, I got to take care of myself, but kishena nili, if I'm only for myself, what am I? So we have these contradictions in life. We've got to take care of ourselves, but we can't only be us, because that's not so nice either. So you have to find some balance. But Rav Shimon said, that's all one idea, that you have to take care of yourself because you're a human being. That's what it means to be human. You have needs, and no one else is going to take care of you. You're the first one responsible to take care of yourself. But you also have the ability to define the word ani in a broader sense. So ani doesn't just have to mean me. It can mean me and my family. It can mean me and my community. It can mean me and the whole Jewish people. It can mean the whole world. So the more broadly you see the concept of ani, the bigger person you are. So it says, that's pshat in the Mishnah, that yes, it's true, it ain't ani li mili. First you take care of yourself. But kishani latzmi, if I define the word ani as just meaning me, the individual, ani, what's the ani? It's not such a big deal. But if you define the ani more broadly, you'll help more people. So it goes out in a straight line that the more you can address the people who are within your circle, that's great, and the bigger you can make your circle, that's fantastic. So you go in a straight line, you try to make the biggest circle possible, and you try to take care of everybody along the way that you can. The others point out, there's another mile here also, that's also from this week's parsha, that the end of Revi, in this week's parsha, so we talk about helping out somebody who needs help with their animal. That somebody's trying to load their animal and they're having a hard time, she's supposed to help them out. And the Gemara understands, based on the pasuk, that if you have to choose, one person is your friend and one person is, Rahman al Aslan, your enemy, so you should help your enemy first. So why should you help your enemy first? Your sone, the person you hate? Says the Gemara, Kidei Lako Fitzono, that we want to try to fight this hatred that you have, that you're going to come to feel better about them if you try to help them. So that's a value. So some Sfarim point out that you see that chesed is also meant to add to communal harmony. The more you help people out who are around you, the better you're going to get along, and the more harmonious tzibur you're going to have. So maybe that's also a part of aniyah yercha, that the people who you interact with, those are the people who you should try to help first, and then if you can help beyond that, that's also a tremendous milah. So we find that the next milah is also to help the is to help the Aniyei Eretz Yisrael, and that's brought in Shulchan Aruch, And that's a whole discussion as well. The Chasam Sofer has a tshuva, and the Torah Tanina writes independently that within Eretz Yisrael, Yerushalayim has priority, but a lot of the postmen didn't accept that. Rav Vosner has a tshuva, they don't assume like that, because the only reason to prioritize Yerushalayim would be Kedusha, and that's assuming that it has the same Kedusha today, and that means we're talking specifically about the old city of Yerushalayim. So practically speaking, the poskim didn't really distinguish between Yerushalayim and the rest of Eretz Yisrael, but that Eretz Yisrael is a priority. Why is it a priority? So maybe because it's a fulfillment of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael, like we see that if you fulfill other mitzvos, that's also a component that affects your sukkah decisions, but also from an Aniyah Yircha perspective, so we're all connected to Eretz Yisrael, we all benefit from Eretz Yisrael, so therefore it's an extended version of Aniyah Yircha. There was an interesting machlokas, lahavdil ben Achaim ben Achaim, the machlokas between Reb Chaim Volozhin and Reb Chaim Sanzer, about if you have a community, let's say the Washington Heights Chevra that makes Aliyah, so now there's a Washington Heights community in Eretz Yisrael, so do they have a preference over the rest of Eretz Yisrael for the people in Washington Heights? So Chaim Volozhin thought, yes, that you still have more of a shaykhus to those people, even in comparison to the other people in Eretz Yisrael. And Reb Chaim Zanzer thought, not. The Munkach Rebbe has a tshuva about this, and the Menachos Lozer about this machlokas that draws on this idea that it's not just about the proximity, it's about you have a shaykhus to, so even we're dealing with equal distances, but you have more of a shaykhus to one community, so then that's also going to draw on your obligation. But practically speaking, most of the poskim assume that Aniyei Eretz Yisrael do not take priority of Aniyei Yircha, that Aniyei Yircha is still before Aniyei Eretz Yisrael. There is somewhat of a discussion about this, but that seems to be the consensus, that Aniyei Yircha is still first, and then after you go past Aniyei Yircha, so then you go to Aniyei Eretz Yisrael. And then through everybody else, and including the whole world also, the Gemara says in Gittin, in the finest in Aniyei Akum and Aniyei Yisrael, that you have responsibility to help everyone in the world. And that's Machlok, it's Rashi and the Ran, but we assume that the Shach Paskin is like the Ran, that it's not just people who, it's not just when you're helping Jews at the same time, but you have an independent obligation to help everybody in the world. That's also a part of the list of priorities. And then the question is, how do you choose between different sources after now we've figured out different people? So we have a major priority for Aniyim, and we have other priorities which are brought in Shulchan Aruch based on the Gemara. So to marry off the Yisoma based on the Mishnah Ksubis that started the whole discussion about Dei Machzoro. So that seems to be the highest priority, and that it seems to also be a Dei Machzoro factor, that this connects so much to one's basic sustenance and one's basic dignity, that that takes a very high priority. And it gets into the whole discussion, what exactly is included in Hachnach Deskala, that that itself is a big staka. That's a whole debate, what exactly is included. It seems to be that that includes maybe three levels under the heading of Hachnach Deskala, that anything that will otherwise keep the wedding from happening, that if the couple's not going to be able to get married because they're lacking certain sustenance, so that's the highest priority. Next would be expenses needed for married life. That's also considered to be a part of Hachnas Kala. And then the expenses of the wedding itself, which is always a topic of debate, just how lavish should weddings be, and what kind of a standard is set for the community when people have very lavish weddings. But to some degree, there has to be some recognition of the event in order to have the proper dignity afforded to the individual. So that's also considered to be within this heading of Knesset Kala. And then we find also that supporting the schools. The Gemara says in the second parakah of Abbasra, there was a takana that there has to be schools in every community. And that's really even more than stalker. That's a part of the basic obligation. The community has to make sure that there's a Talmud Torah for all the people and that that's provided for everybody. It's really a major issue that we have today, whether or not that's really being addressed in the proper fashion. And that has to be provided as a basic communal service. And then there was a discussion, Moshe Feinstein has a tshuva, we talk about Talmud Torah, so there's two types of Talmud Torah. There's a Talmud Torah of the children, and there's a Talmud Torah of the, let's say, the Kol guys who could become the poskim. You need to have poskim and Torah teachers, so you have to make sure that they're able to be supported long enough to reach that stage. So how do you decide between the two? So he has a tshuva about that, but he assumes that you have to prioritize the children as long as the older Talmidei Chachamim are able to live. And that's a little bit of a discretionary decision as well. And then you have also a Beis HaKnesses, which was brought in the Shulchan Aruch to take care of the obligations, making sure that you have a shul, making sure that you have all of the basic needs of a community. All of this is included with as a stock of values. It's a question how exactly to assess what's the most pressing. It's hard sometimes to talk in absolutes because there are always different degrees. So the Shulchan Aruch says that the Beis Knesset is a big priority. So Rav Osner and others have truths about this. What do we mean when we say Beis Knesset is a priority? Do we mean because there's no other shul? Do we mean giving a fancier wall to the shul? You already have a shul. So how exactly do you rank different aspects of different needs? It takes a lot of judgment and a lot of awareness of what the practical issues are. So these are major components. So just to take out a few minutes, and then we're supposed to talk about Maestro Ksofim. So just to talk about that for a few minutes. So Maestro Ksofim is a little bit of a difficult topic to talk about because it's a little bit murky as far as how to paskin rules in Maestro Ksofim. And Rabbi Yehuda has a tshuva where somebody asked him about Maestro Ksofim, and he says that he's uncomfortable talking about it in a halachic sense because it doesn't really have makaris and shas. It's not really something that's dealt with in the Talmud, so he can't deal with it in a typical halachic sense, so he's a little uncomfortable with it. So essentially, there is a debate. The idea that one should give one-tenth of his money to tzedakah is a very wonderful idea. That is agreed upon by everybody, and it's a very fantastic deal. The question is just what level of concept is it? So,
is it one-tenth when?
So that's also a question. So how you address the questions is going to all depend on how, that's what I was a little bit introducing, that it's a little bit tricky to talk about some of the details, but just to give a better sense of the whole picture, figure out how the details flow from there. So if you assume that Meiser is a Din Min HaTorah, which would be supported in the Tosfos and Masechet Tainis and Daf Tes, which quotes the Sifra, that has a drasha on the Pasuk, that Ser Taser, a kol tvuasecha, I think the pasuk says the word kol. There's a drasha there, which means all the profit that you get from all of your business dealings. So that's the basis to say that it is a concept min haTorah. Most of the poskim don't assume that way. That there's some that Taz assumes that it's a din derabbanan, it's not a drasha gemura, and others assume that it's not a din midrabbanan either. That it's really a minig. And then we talk about a minig, so what does a minig mean? So a minig sometimes is a minig klal Yisrael, this is what all the Jews do. And sometimes we mean that it's a hanhaga tova, that it's a good type of behavior to take on. So many assume that it's a second version, that really this is something that as an individual one is highly encouraged to take on as a personal practice, but it doesn't have the authority of a din min haTorah or a din min haRabbanan, or even a minig in the universal sense that this is what everyone does, but that this is something that you do if you're able to. So this is going to affect the details. It's going to affect how you make decisions. That if it's a din min haTorah, so it's essentially it's an extension of Maaser Ani, so it would really follow all the rules of Maaser Ani, and it would have to be with a hafrasha, you'd have to set it aside formally, and that it would be something that only goes to Anim, doesn't go to all the other good causes, only goes to that which qualifies as an Ani. If it's different level of obligation, so then it could be more flexible in terms of how it's dispersed and how it's assessed. And especially if you say that it's a personal hanhaga, then really it does seem to be that there's some latitude for the individual who's deciding whether to take it on or not to take it on based on the terms that seem to work best for them. So that's a whole discussion, so you won't get into so much detail about how to address that. But certainly to emphasize, none of that is meant to in any way minimize the tremendous significance of this practice. Practice is highly encouraged, and it's a reflection of one of our core values as Jewish people. And Chazal, the Rambam writes in Hilchos Melachim that Avraham Avinu was Mafresh Maaser. This is something that we have going back to the Avos, and it's something that's reflective of a core value. So there's no question that it is a minig that goes to the very essence of what it means to be a Jewish person. So this, none of this analysis is meant to in any way subtract from that. But it does play a role in terms of determining the details. And the assumption is that this is only relevant for somebody who is able to afford this. If someone is himself taking tzedakah, so he's not obligated in Maaser. He is obligated in the mitzvah of tzedakah. In a basic sense, we call a shlishus hashekel, a third of a shekel a year, which is not very much, but there is a basic obligation of an ani to give staka, which you might say, what's the point? So you just he'll have to collect more staka in order to take more staka. Doesn't necessarily mean that. It could mean that he'll have to skimp even more in order to give a little bit, but that presumably reflects the Valachta Midrachav idea that nobody should be exempt from giving staka on some level. Even if you are yourself taking staka, you still have to be involved in the mitzvah of staka as a reflection of Valachta Midrachav. But as far as Meiser, so Meiser as a concept really is only going to be relevant to somebody who is able to pay his own bills, and he's not going to have to take any more from his parents or from anybody else. So then what's left, he can give Meiser after that. Say what's left, that was a discussion, there was a minority view that you only assess it based on what's left after you're paying all your expenses. The majority assume that it's off of the top, but when you say what's left, I mean assuming that you're able to cover all of your basic expenses, so then you're not taking staka from anyone else, so then we could talk about a practice of Meister. There is a lot written about whether it can be used towards tuition. That's still always a highly charged topic. I think it's a little bit of a tricky topic to assess, because here we have a society nowadays where the vast majority of people are struggling to pay tuition in the basic sense. So if the trade-off is going to pay Meister and then you're not going to be able to pay tuition, so that's difficult to say, because then presumably your first priority is to pay the tuition. So then it's very often, you could call that your Meister money, call it not your Meister money. It very often has not so much of a ramification. The question is whether the tuition system should be set up differently so that we can be more involved in staka. That's a little bit of also a charged question. So it's a little bit outside the scope of what we can really address today. So that's a part of why it's not such a easy topic to address head on. But certainly there is this encouragement to give Meiser. And the Gemara has this limit that one shouldn't give more than a fifth, because the risk is that they may become impoverished. There are a lot of exceptions. The Chafetz Chaim writes in Avos Chesed that there are a lot of exceptions to the idea. We extend this rule not just to tzedakah, we extend it to mitzvahs also. That's based on the Ramah. The Ramah writes in Hilchos Lulav that the idea that you shouldn't spend more than a fifth of your money on tzedakah means also by mitzvahs. If a positive mitzvah is going to cost you, if a lulav and esrog is going to cost you more than a fifth of your money, so then you're not obligated to do it, you're off the hook. And the Ramah writes, not everyone agrees with this part, the Ramah writes, that's not true by alosa, say, that if it's a negative mitzvah, so then you have to spend all of your money. But if it's a positive mitzvah, you only have to spend a fifth. The Gomel Gaon disagreed with that. He says negative mitzvahs are treated like positive mitzvahs too. But the Gemara is talking about stock. The Gemara says that this was a takana that they made in Usha, that one should only give a fifth of his money, otherwise he may become impoverished, and that's a problem. But among the exceptions, so you find that this is true about the average person. The average person is making an average income in order to live, so then the assumption is if they're going to give more than a fifth of what they have, it's going to compromise their ability to continue functioning. But if somebody's an Asher Muflug, if somebody's a billionaire, so he could give away 99.9% of his money, he'll still be richer than the rest of us. So certainly the fifth limitation is not going to apply to somebody who's an Asher Muflug. Some say there are other exceptions as well. There's a whole discussion that comes from the Gemara itself, the same Gemara in Ksubis, about maybe this doesn't apply after the person dies. The person is talking about the estate. So what kind of estate are they going to leave their inheritors? So there's a little bit of a tension there that the Gemara says, on the one hand, he's not bound to a one-fifth limitation. He can give more than a fifth. On the other hand, the Gemara says in Baba Basra and elsewhere that there's an idea you're not supposed to be maver nachala, but under normal circumstances, a person has yorshin, so he shouldn't disinherit his yorshin. So there has to be some balance, the whole discussion of the posting, exactly how this balance comes about. But you shouldn't disinherit your heirs, but you're not necessarily bound to a one-fifth limitation. But during your lifetime, if you're not ridiculously wealthy, or even moderately wealthy, let's say, so you have this one-fifth limitation. That's how it sounds from the Gemara. The Rambam in one place sounds like that you're encouraged l'chachila to go for a fifth of staka. So it's a little bit of a question whether a fifth is the maximum or a fifth is the general recommendation. And the Chafetz Chaim writes in his Sefer that in the Sefer Avos Chesed, that he thinks that in general, if nobody's asking you, so then we say, give a tenth, and maximum of a fifth. But if people are banging down your door because there's a tremendous need everywhere, so then we'll say that even l'chafilo, you should give a fifth and try to do what you can in order to take care of the aniyim. So there's probably a lot more to say about that, but these are just some of the general principles, so maybe we'll just recap a little bit what we spoke about, and I think we'll just be out of time. But essentially, so we spoke about the fact that the mitzvah of tzedakah has two core elements to it, just like chesed. It has a component of acting godlike, and it has a component of helping people, v'lachta b'drachav, and v'yahavta r'yecha kamocha, and normally those two ideals work in parallel, but sometimes they have different points of emphasis. And we spoke about the fact that tzedakah is unique and that there are halachos, there are clearly rules, but at the same time, there's always going to be discretion, and it's a careful blend of the two, of using these rules to inform your discretion. So if you're going to be a rabbi, so rabbinic discretion is what you're trying to obtain. And the Vilna Gaon had that vort, that clenching your fist is meant to represent the idea of looking like everything's equal, like everything could be plugged into a computer and analyzed that way, when in reality, there's always going to be a need to be more aware of the variables and the discretionary elements. So we spoke about the question of, should you diversify or give one big lump? So there were those who say you should give them one big gift, but the majority seems to assume that you should give more diversified, and the Rambam and the Bach both say that for different reasons. The Rambam says to do it because you'll strengthen your Valach Devadrachav. The Bach says it'll be more helpful to the world, and Shulchan Aruch says you shouldn't give to everything to one person. The Marsham assumed that was true only in a long-term idea, but to give one month by month is okay. We mentioned how there's a distinction between public money and private money. Private money, you can give, for the Rambam's reasons, public money, you have to have more of an objective sense. Yaakov Kamenetsky pointed out that you have a responsibility also to make sure people continue to give. We talked also about the question of De Machzoro, what exactly De Machzoro means. Talked a little bit about the Gemara, where basically it means that which is lacking, which we see in the Gemara defined maybe in three ways. Basic human needs that everyone is entitled to, needs people are used to if they're accustomed to a certain higher standard, and a communal standard, which also affects what people who live in the community are going to feel like they need. And talked a little bit about how you balance the more extreme examples given in the Gemara with basic and communal responsibility, and we talked about how any of that could work with the idea of not spending more than a fifth. We mentioned that it was a machlokas whether De Machzoro applies to individuals or only to the community. The Ramah and the Vazner says Matthias assumes that it applies to the community as a whole, but we still made a distinction that the communal fund really doesn't go based on De Machzoro, it goes based on more objective standards. The individual has a notion of De Machzoro, and the Chiv of De Machzoro is the aggregate of individuals together should hopefully try to accomplish De Machzoro. And we talked about somebody who's able to work and doesn't, the Machlokas about that, about somebody who has money doesn't want to support himself, the discussion in the Gemara and the Machlokas about that. And we talked about the Lavin. When do the Lavin apply? Do they apply anytime you say no? We talked about the Machlokas between the Rambam and the day accorded in the Rashba. If you have to have a Tzviya, if somebody's actually asking you, the Rambam's assumption that even if you just know about it, like it sounds from the Gemara, that you could be in violation of these Lavin, but that the Lavin are only applicable to somebody who cruelly refuses to, who says, it's not my problem, I don't have to worry about it. So that's where you have an obligation of, we have a subjectivity to these lavin. But if you have good reasons, like you're maxed out on your tzedakah, or you don't have any money, or you have other priorities, or the person is possibly a liar, like the Gemara says, we have to be grateful for the Ramayim, so then one's not going to be probably in violation of these lavin. And then we talked about the priority of relatives, which only applies to private money, not to public money, and a specific priority given to parents, and the details that emerge from that, and the priority theoretically given to people who are more righteous, but that's not brought so much nowadays, but that only applies to public money, not to private money, that's the reverse. And then we spoke about Aniyei Yerecha Kodmin. What does Aniyei Yerecha mean? How does it rack up against different needs, the interpretation of the Pasuk, Yedecha Evyon, and the question of what's the reason, the definition of Aniyei Yerecha? Is it based on proximity, position of the Rebar Baruch against the Torah? is probably based on shaychus and people you have more of an involvement with. We talked about the expanding circle of chesed and also the idea that there's greater harmony if you're involved in helping the people around you. And so therefore, presumably that's the thinking of Aniya Yerecha, and therefore people who you happen to be involved with more, probably less connected to geography. And we talked about the Ma'il of Eretz Yisrael. Most of the posts don't accept the Chassam Sofer, the Yerushalayim is special within that. But community that's identifiable with you, maybe that's a different story, according to Chaim Velazhner. And presumably, most assume that Aniya Yerecha is still a higher priority than Aniya Eretz Yisrael, so Aniya Eretz Yisrael comes next. And then we talked about the rest of the world, and the Baris and the Akum, and that's also an obligation. And then we talked about some of the various causes within, about the Yisoma, about the Talmud Torah, about the Beis HaKnesses, about things like that. And then a little bit about Maaser K'safim, about whether it's a Chiyuv D'oraisa, a Chiyuv D'rabbanan, a Minhag Klal Yisrael, a Minhag the individual, how that's going to affect how it's given out, about whether or not it's applicable to somebody who doesn't really have his own income, about the very thorny question about how does that affect tuition payments and things like that, and about talking about the upper limitation of Chomesh and about how there are exceptions to that, and question somebody who's very wealthy, somebody who's talking about it in the state, and in general balancing the two. And our hope is that just the very discussion of these topics is also a key in Balach de Bedracha. The more you're thinking about these ideas, the more that refines this godlike personality, the more that creates a personality, the image of God. And we have the beautiful synergy that the more you are such a person, then hopefully the more you will be engaged in the acts of staka. And we're told that this is what defines the Jewish people and their character and their essence, and it should be our schus that the more we talk about staka, the more we'll be involved in staka, the more we're involved, the more we'll be people of staka, we'll be people of chesed, and people of rachamim, and we will more fully attain our tafkid in this world to be comparable and similar to a Kadosh Baruch Hu. Thank you very much. I thank Rabbi Orlean for the invitation. Any further issues? We should,
hi.
So I assume two things. You know, first of all, I don't know exactly what his thinking was, whether that he's making a mashliach of his to give his tzedakah. Presumably, you know, to involve somebody in tzedakah from the Havalach de Bedracha component, you know, that's probably valuable in any sense of the word. Same way we tell our children, or we give our children money, and we tell them to go put it in the tzedakah box. You know, it's part of training a sensitive personality. In terms of you're not really increasing the amount of stock in the world, so strictly speaking, there isn't that much to be accomplished by giving someone else money to give stock from that perspective. But I think it does accomplish something by involving more people in the mitzvah of stakka, and probably got more stakka to be given. So from those perspectives, that's something that's valuable. It's also a part of the discussion. We said before that money has to give stakka, so the Sfarim talk about it. So that means he's got to ask from somebody else to get stakka for him to give stakka. So that's a little bit harder to say. It probably means more that he should skim even more than he normally does and give a little bit of it. But there is some room to say that, yes, even if it means just having an extra middleman and taking money from somebody else and putting it right back into tzedakah, that's valuable because of the lachta b'drachah component. You wouldn't want to do that in great amounts because that's very impractical. But in small amounts, to have some involvement in the mitzvah of tzedakah for everyone, I think there's something to that.
Somebody like who would be supported by the parents in the hello letter, so we discuss myself.
The skimp, you know, it's a scrimp. You know, they should give a little bit of tzedakah. They're chayiv in the shlishis hashekel, so they definitely should be involved in tzedakah on some level, not on the maisa level, but on a smaller level. And it makes more sense not for them to go to the parents and ask them for more. If the parents, you know, are very able, so they think that's that. Okay, I'm giving my kid an allowance and I'm giving them a certain amount of money for clothes and a certain amount of money in tzedakah because I want them to be involved. That's a fine thing for the parents to do. It's probably very valuable from a chinuch perspective, but in general, the idea that the parents have to burden themselves so that they can give extra money to give to the children so that they can give tzedakah doesn't make so much sense. And the idea of the child giving tzedakah really means that so they have their allowance for their food, and they'll have a little bit less food. They'll take some of the money from that, and they'll give to tzedakah, not that they'll go ask for more. Passions.
Yes.
Okay. All right. So, I did actually ask that. So thank you for that. All right, everyone, have a wonderful Shabbos. Stay safe and stay dry.